Are we live?
Yep, you're live, Todd. We just got through the intro.
Okay, good. Yeah, let me first apologize to everybody who downloads and listens. I am currently on the road in Pocatello, Idaho, at the first Mountain West Fire Conference. Very, very unique event. A lot of incredible speakers. I had a great day listening and learning, but I did not want to miss this opportunity, at least to be a small part of the podcast tonight, just for the mere fact of the guest. And I don't know, Anthony, just kind of fill me in. I apologize for being a second late there. Have you done introductions for our guests this evening?
No, you got in as soon as the intro ended.
Okay, great. Well, let me welcome everybody in like I usually do. I'm going to do like we always do with our introductions. And again, just as a reminder, I'm Todd Edwards, 30 plus years of Atlanta Fire Rescue, currently retired, and very fortunate, very blessed to get to work with some of the best people across the country and constantly still learning new things every day. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. And for my co-host this evening, you introduce yourself.
Anthony Rowett, I'm a captain with the Mobile Fire Department, Mobile, Alabama. Been here 14 years and volunteered in northern New Jersey for 3 years before that. And for the past few years, got to be on the road and get to learn from and work alongside some of the guys like Todd, our guest tonight before, and a bunch of the other guys that are kind of awesome to get to learn from. So, like usual, pretty excited to hear what our guest has to say tonight on the topics we're going to talk about.
Awesome. And what... Again, our guest this evening can't do anything for me. He's not going to give me any kind of money or pay raises, but truly excited. And I'm a little bit disappointed that I'm on the road this week, just the way the schedule fell with the podcast and this particular conference that I won't be able to stay on. But I definitely wanted to be a part of the introduction phase of this. Our guest tonight has become a true mentor of mine. I've read his book, I think, twice now. I've got half of it highlighted, so may have to get a new version of it. But I kind of even joke sometimes that he may be America's fire chief, just how he is. I have one question I am going to get in right after he introduces himself, because I got to get this question in, and I don't want to forget it. So if you could introduce yourself, Chief, to the audience, we'd appreciate it.
Brother, thank you for having me on. It's an honor to be on. And Todd, you're way too kind, but thank you. And I learn equal, if not more, from both of you, and love seeing you on the road and hearing what you guys got to say. But glad to be here. My name is Scott Thompson, and I've been in the fire service going on close to 40 years. Started my career in Plano, Texas, and had a few stops, went from there to Arlington, Texas, as their one and only outside training chief. I'm very passionate about training. That's my love. Was there a bit, and never really had the desire to become a fire chief, but I figured I was going to put up or shut up, and if I wanted to see the change that I wanted to see in our fire service, that I needed to put myself in that position. So I took a chief's job in Athens, Texas, and then Lake Cities, which is real close to Louisville. I was having coffee with one of my mentors, Rick Lasky, one morning, and he offered me the training chief job in Louisville. So I actually went from fire chief down to training chief, division chief of training, which was probably the best move in my career. I learned so much from him and working with the guys and gals in Louisville. And then the Colony job came open, and I saw a lot of potential here, and so I took the Chiefs job in 2009. So I've been here going on 14 years, and it's been just a tremendous experience, a lot of great things. I got to tell you, I got some fantastic men and women who make this whole thing work, and I'm just kind of the head cheerleader and get them what they need, and so I'm going to do a few more years and tap out, and that's about it, gentlemen.
Yeah, and for the guys who have never heard the name Scott Thompson or the Colony, saw his book, his mentoring, and what he offers up to the fire service at no charge on his mentoring program is absolutely amazing. But one of the things, and I'm just going to kind of back up something he just said. He truly means what he says about he's just the head cheerleader. I probably understated in a lot of ways. I've met a lot of his staff, chief officers, and people that come to conferences, and they're all absolutely top shelf firefighters and believe in the fire service and believe in what we're doing here. So this is another shout out to him and what he's doing to his staff. But here's my question. I had to get this question in.
Okay.
What do you think is the key to being a solid fire chief? Not a battalion, not a company officer, but just being a fire chief, in your opinion.
Wow, that's a tough question. So I'm going to answer that in two ways. There's two types of fire chiefs out there. I primarily talk about the suburban fire service. I always like to throw that in there because I don't want to represent something that I really haven't been a part of. So, 500 members or less. But there's two types out there. And they're good people trying to do their best, but they're those chiefs that are kind of programmed. They take the traditional track and go to the traditional classes, and they're influenced by more experienced chiefs who kind of tell them what a chief should be. And then there's what I kind of like to call the kind of independent thinkers, the ones who are the students who do the research themselves and learn the job based on their situation, their experiences, and the people they want to be influenced by. And that's the route I've chosen. Unfortunately, in our fire service, you got to kind of pick. You got to kind of pick to be a part of the men and women who are doing the job or to be a part of the fire chief clique, for lack of a better term. And I chose to really listen to what firefighters are doing. So to me, one of the things that we lost, I think, in fire chiefs is an understanding of the job. Now, I'm not talking about the chief going out and stretching and throwing and forcing and searching. Of course, hopefully they've done that, but I think first of all is you got to understand the job, and a lot of fire chiefs will disagree with that. They want to stay at 30,000 feet. I can tell you this: since I started going to firefighter conferences, I have learned just volumes. So that's number one is understanding the job. Maybe not at the technique level, but certainly at the task, tactics, and strategic level. The other thing is simply this: We love to say, as the higher you go up, the less it becomes about you. And we seem to apply that right up till the time it becomes fire chief. And then when we become fire chief, it's back about us again. But if I'm the highest level in the organization, then I should be given the most, and I should invest the most in the organization. So it's a student of our craft, of our profession, which is a science and an art. And it's just wanting to give back to the organization. One of the most important things that I do is position my people for success and survival, and that looks a lot of different ways. And so those are things that a chief has to do. And of course, they've got to, I hate to use the term politician, but they have to understand kind of the local politics and know how to work those things. They have to have an understanding of things like finance and HR. Those things are all important. But what's more important is how you use those things to really positively influence each and every member of the organization. So, you know, that's kind of what I would say. If you were to ask me how do you define fire chief success, it's to just learn as much as you can about this. Because, you know, like it or not, fire chiefs do have a heavy influence. They decide where the dollars go. They approve policies and procedures. And so to do that, you really got to kind of be in tune with the work that the men and women who are riding the fire trucks, what they're doing. And I feel very passionate about that. And I try to surround myself with fire chiefs and fire officers who have that similar belief.
Yeah, you couldn't have answered that. I don't think anybody could have answered that as well as you did. And we've known each other now for a while, and it's been truly every time I'm around you, I always pick up a little something more. But I think the one thing, and I hope the listeners and everybody who downloads and listens to this later gets that the one factor that I've always gotten from Chief Thompson is that he's always humble, and I think that goes a long way when you're able to go to fires and you're not trying to show off your bugles and your white helmet that you're the fire chief. He's definitely able to maintain a very command presence while still being, you know, part of the overall system and understand the importance of the guys, the men and the women who are riding these fire rigs. And I have always tried to model that. I still try to model that, whether I'm on a rig or I'm at my part-time or I'm just teaching. I always try to keep that in mind. And for that, I got to thank him just for always sharing that with me as well. And I want to personally apologize to you know, both my co-host Anthony and Scott for having to be off here tonight. I'm actually getting ready to go to dinner with some unbelievable guys right now. Ray McCormick, Steve Robson, and Clyde Davis are from Houston. We're all about to go out to dinner at this conference, and bad timing on my part, bad schedule on my part, but personally, so I can get off of here and get with these guys, I want to thank you for just spending the time and sharing your knowledge with our listeners tonight, Chief. And Anthony's going to kind of direct. I think we're going to hear a lot for everybody's listening, a lot about how to mentor the upcoming youth for this job. And Scott, thank you so much for spending the evening with Anthony and for being on this podcast tonight, sir. We really do appreciate that. And thank you for everybody continuing to support this podcast. And Anthony, I will talk to you later on this evening, brother. I appreciate you, bro.
Thank you, Todd, for all your kind words. And thank you for everything you do, man. I get a ton from you, so keep doing what you're doing. And tell those guys hello. I just saw Ray and Steve a couple days ago, but please tell them hello for me.
Yeah, they all were yelling at me when I was trying to talk to you. They were all yelling at me, tell them we said hi. So, you know, you can't be around these guys on the phone.
Well, go have fun, man.
You guys have a great evening, and I will talk to both of you very soon. Thanks, thanks, Anthony, for taking care of everything, bro.
Yeah, sounds good.
Bye, buddy.
Bye.
All right, so, Chief, I got a couple things I want to kind of go into to start it and then just kind of let you go as deep as you want to in the topics kind of your name brings up and in my mind and probably most people's mind of being culture and mentoring. But kind of going into what you talked about with, you know, what you think a good fire chief is and how you go about it. You know, one of the first times I met you was in Pensacola Beach, and I remember, you know, here's the fire chief of his fire department sitting in the front row with his firefighters at an engine conference. You know, and that left a lasting impact on me because it's not like, oh, he's a district chief or battalion chief, and, he, you know, he lives in the station with these guys or he's, you know, going to calls with these guys. It was very, you know, obvious because I've read the book. I know who you are, that this is the chief of the department, and he's sitting with not other chiefs. He's sitting with firefighters while they learn how to get better at their craft and being alongside of them and supporting them and not just saying it's important, but showing it. And then, you know, I remember we were out at the pool. Everyone was talking. Everyone was kind of around you listening to some ideas on leadership and mentoring, and I'm listening to you. And you were talking about different things and going to classes and remembering where you came from. And I was going, man, I see why a lot of people want to work for this guy. But then we were up in the room when you weren't there and there was people from your department in the room. And we were talking about it. And I was like, man, if you guys haven't had anyone quit in this many years, are you guys like the highest paid in the area? Or like, liking the guy you're working for goes so far, but most people, a lot of people are driven by money anymore. I mean, I see it in my job. A lot of people go to other departments just because they pay more. And they were like, no, we're not the highest paid. People around us make more. We just want to work for him. And, you know, that stood with me, that's leadership that these guys, it's not like they were saying it for you because you weren't there. They were saying it without you there. But that's the leadership that you know, that you impressed on them. And one thing I've heard you talk about when you teach, that to me it's something that would stand out to me, you know, as a firefighter, as an officer, if that's the mentality of the chief of the department, is when you talk about being fire first. And the way when you took the job, you started to develop the culture of your department and set it up the way you wanted and implement your philosophies of how the department was going to operate, and that it was fire first. And when you kind of give everyone the story like you do in your class on what that means to you and the way you were setting your department up as being fire first.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, Andy, I'd be remiss if I didn't say it's, you know, I don't get to see my people as much as I like. And it's, you know, I'm a little bit removed, obviously, being at headquarters. So there's a lot of our senior men and women, our company officers, our battalion chiefs, our op chiefs, division chiefs that make all this work. And I think the key is we all share a common philosophy. But, you know, we are a fire department, and we go out and we try to recruit the best people we can. I mean, that's very important, right? My job, my citizens expect me to put the best team on the field. And so I take that very, very seriously. And what we do, unfortunately, is we go out and we try to hire the best firefighters we can, and then we try to make them something different. And there's fundamentally something wrong with that. And that's where the first kind of conflict begins. I like to say I'm a firefighter with fire chief responsibilities. I love the job. I love being a firefighter. I love hanging around with firefighters. And the reason why I said kind of set up the fire first philosophy is, if you think about it, the greatest investment in any fire department organization is in its firefighting and fire rescue capabilities, is it not? You know, you look at fire apparatus, protective clothing, all the stuff we put is investing in that. We spend a lot more on that than we do on EMS. We spend a lot more, you know, overall. So it only makes sense to me that if our citizens give us that capability, if I go ask for a $1.2 million tower ladder, an $800,000 pumper, and they give that to me, and they give me three or four well-trained, well-compensated professionals to put on that, I've got to have a return on that investment. And so, you know, the letting firefighters be firefighters is just that. The follow-up to that is the firefighters that get it know what that means. You know, it's both ways. The title, to me, of firefighter is something to wear very proudly. But with that comes great responsibility. So by having that fire-first preparedness philosophy, it's just really saying, hey, we just want you to do what we're hiring you to do. We're not gonna throttle you down and let you be a fraction of that. You know, we like to say, I want you to be an aggressive problem solver right up to reckless. And in my mind, and I say this because I went out and asked our citizens, that's exactly what the people who pay for us to exist expect. They want professional, aggressive problem solvers to show up on their fire, rescue, or medical emergency and take care of business. And if you look at the big picture, you know, I get way too much credit for saying that, but in reality, it's just doing what the citizens expect us to do, nothing more, nothing less. The problem is, as fire chiefs, and I'm talking, you know, I started off in the beginning about the program ones who've listened to other fire chiefs, and they try to be something they're not. Is we don't ask the right people. We don't ask our citizens. We don't ask our business owners. We don't ask our city leaders in the chamber and the rotary and all those really what they expect. But if you do, the answer is going to be very clear. They want aggressive problem solvers to be ready and willing at any point in time to come take care of business. So all I want to do is create an environment that promotes that. Now, what was not anticipated through all that is that's going to attract a certain type of, you know, if you just have that culture that supports firefighters being firefighters, then those are the type of people you're going to attract. And I always get questions about recruitment and retention. And the very first thing I ask is, well, why would somebody want to come work for you? And a lot of times they don't have a good answer. We train a lot. We're very passionate about that. We like to be aggressive on fires, right up to reckless. We take great pride in the title of a firefighter. We have a very, very good EMS system. You know, we have single-role paramedics on our ambulances. Everybody in our organization is a paramedic. That's very important. But the greatest investment in the Colony Fire Department, I'm just going to talk about what I know, is in firefighting, fire rescue capabilities. So I just want to bring the people into the organization that's going to maximize that. They're going to use those tools to the maximum capability to solve people's problems. And it's really that simple.
No, I had the phone on mute, so I wouldn't interrupt you, and I couldn't get it off. So I want to build on something you said because I was going to do it later, and you kind of went into it. So recently, when they put it out, I kind of thought about it from hearing you teach and talk and reading your book. Our fire chief recently put out his 5-year strategic plan for the fire department to the city and everything, and in it they had done surveys of citizens, business owners, and all this of what all types of things, what they expect from the fire department, what's been their good experiences with the fire department, what's been bad, all that. And, I mean, it wasn't a surprise to me, but it went exactly to what you said. The number one thing on their list of expectations was fire responses. That's what people think of when they think of the fire department. But when you go into, you know, when you went out and asked the people, a lot of people that have heard of the Colony Fire Department, and maybe it's just through social media or through pictures they've seen, they've all seen the same picture. And it's the "we will come for you" on the back of the engine. Now, to me, I mean, and to some people that might not mean a lot, but to me, if I got a fire chief who's willing to put that on the engine and state that to somebody and state "we will come for you," that's a powerful statement to tell somebody. You're not guessing anymore. You're telling the citizen what the expectation is. They're not guessing it. What you should do, you're telling them, "We will come for you." To me, that would garner a lot of support from me, as a company officer or even as a firefighter years ago. That's the statement this department is making, because that's what I came on the fire department for. I didn't come on, you know, to be timid. I came on to do what's asked of us and to try to help somebody. If it's burning, we want to go in it if we can. Has that been the response you've had from your members since, you know, you put that on the truck, that really just solidified what they wanted to be and it drove that culture that you're kind of known for in your fire department?
Yes, yes. You know, it's a great exercise. If you're a company officer or either a senior man, we're having huge storms here, so we may lose power. This may get crazy, but if it does, that's the reason. But you think about it. You take a 3 or 4 or 5-person fire company, and you just sit down and you ask the question at roll call or at supper time is, hey, what are we willing to promise, guarantee the neighborhood that we protect? And are we willing to put it in writing? And that's kind of where it started. Now, some of my members here actually probably think it's kind of corny because they're constantly getting their chops busted by the cities around us. You know, they'll see them at the grocery store, and they'll bust their balls a little bit about that. Ooh, you know, the Colony, we will come for you. But Garrett Rice kind of really started it. And it was just that. It's like, you know, what are we about? What do we want to be thought of in the community? And so it has been huge. I was a little surprised just how much our citizens would recognize that and how much they would jump on board with it. It's a very powerful statement. But, yes, you can't put it on a rig if you're not going to live up to it. And I talk about two situations. One was during our huge snowstorm we had here where our Engine 11 responded to a mayday. in a neighboring city, and there was only two fire companies on the scene, us and theirs, and our crew went up and was able to resolve the mayday, and they did a really, really good job. And then not long after that, we had another mutual aid fire where we went. It was during a lightning storm. Everybody was out, and they did a bang-up job. This was Engine 12, three-person company. They hooked at a hydrant. They stretched the first line. They got to the second floor. They searched off the line. They got up there, and they basically got the fire under control before anybody else showed up on scene. And kind of talking about it, that was kind of the thing. It says, hey, that's kind of what we do, Chief, you know, and then we put it on our rigs, and in their mind, that's kind of what it looks like. So it's you know, the mission, our purpose, statements like that bring an organization together, and I think a lot of organizations need that. They need something to focus on to create unity and not separation. I know Howard Reinwald in East Montgomery County, I think there says either seconds count or we count seconds. But, yeah, it steps up your game a little bit. When you put it in writing, there's a little bit more pressure, if you will, to live up to that. So it's paid tremendous dividends in our organization. When people come into our organization, like right now we're hiring some paramedics. We just hired some firefighter paramedics, and we can say, here, you know, in a short phrase, this is what we're about. Are you willing to live up to this? And, you know, that kind of answers a lot of questions. Now, you know, we have bad days like everybody else, but in the beginning of each tour of duty, I have a very brief statement that I expect from everybody in the Colony Fire Department, and that's to be mentally, physically, mechanically, and procedurally prepared to do four things, and kind of adding a fifth to it. But the first is to take care of people, them and us. Now, that can be our prevention division. That can be our fleet. That can be our communications. It's the whole system. Is we're here to take care of people, them and us, in that order. The second is to maximize our capabilities, and I explained that earlier, to take all the things that we've had and maximize that to solve problems. I got them a little out of order. To solve problems using all available resources. The third is to maximize or to manage risks inside and outside the firehouse. The fourth is to maximize capabilities. And the fifth we're adding is to minimize that zero impact period. So in 45 seconds, and it all starts with that mud flap, in 45 seconds or less, we as an organization can describe what success looks like. And if we hit those benchmarks, in my opinion, as the person who at the end of the day is responsible, but if we meet those benchmarks, then we're doing what we need to be doing. And that mud flap is just our written commitment, if you will, to our community saying we're going to be there for you. But it's also for our members. You know, we're going to come for you, too. If you get in a bind, if you get in trouble, we're going to be there for you, too. So it really has been cool just to see how people have responded to that.
As you actually touched on what my next question was going to be. So I'll tell it to you. If there's more you want to add to it, let me know. If not, I'll move on. So I was going to say, as the chief of department, so because most times my interactions get to be more with, in our terms in my department, more of a district chief and a deputy chief, people I'm making calls with or that are doing the station inspection. I do interact with the assistant chiefs and the fire chief, the chief of department, just because their offices are in our firehouse. But it's not as, you know, it's not as informal. It's not on a call. You didn't just get to do what you're here to do. You know, they're not there in those moments. How do you, as the chief of department, what are your expectations of your people, but not just in – what's your four general expectations? Do you let your chiefs, your company officers, and then your firefighters know what your expectations of them are? And then how do you do that? And because I think that's where some people have a hard time, because they read one thing and it says it needs to be in writing. And some people, their personality, they don't want to put it in writing. They just want to go have a sit-down with someone when they come into a company and let them know this is the expectation. How do you go about that? Being in the position you're in as the chief of the department.
I have some very broad expectations, and some will disagree with this, but I'll give you an example. So my expectation to my three battalion chiefs, my shift commanders, is I want us to be more alike than we are different. So it really starts there. You know, I don't want A shift to do it different from B shift, to do it different from C shift and station one or station five. I want us to be uniform and predictable in our fire ground operations. So it kind of starts there. Now, what that looks like is up to the men and women that ride the trucks, right? I don't get into to what that uniformity or that consistency is, but I want it. You know, I don't get into the hose that we carry or the ladders that we carry. Mine is more about the operational philosophy and what we're kind of about. I put those things out there that I talked about. I want us to be aggressive problem solvers. You know, a lot of things that Brunicini said, I want us to be nice. We're going to, you know, do all we can for the community, but also internally is to be we call it a high performance learning culture. We're real big into training. The mentoring program is a component of that, so that we have some things where we invest in our members. But it all kind of started, and I'm going to tell on myself. It started out as a shortcut, and I'm against shortcuts. I usually say, you know, you got to put in the work. But because I'd worked several other places, when I got to the colony, I was trying to high-speed, low-drag. So I was trying to think of the quickest way that we could get us up to speed. So I created something called the Excellence Vision and Professional Standards. And what I did is I took my first 6 months here, I went around to the firehouses and I asked the members who would talk to me what they wanted from their new chief. And I was getting some great feedback. So I took what I heard from our members and this vision of what I thought success looked like, and I put it all down on paper in a packet. And I gave it to each of my battalion chiefs at the time, and I said, do what you want with this. But it answered basically all the questions, what was important to me, what wasn't. And I said, do what you want. It's not a policy. It's not a procedure. Throw it in the trash. Well, one by one, they all came to me and said, Chief, thank you for this. It's the best thing we've ever had. Now, it's not about the content. It was the fact that they had a document that they could sit down with the men and women they were in charge of and really explain what we were about, what success looked like, and the big picture. And they'd never had a tool like that. So that's kind of – and now today, parts of that are seen in our hiring process, probationary process, certainly our mentoring process, and our promotional process. And that focuses on our core values, which are duty, respect, integrity, our purpose, and our mission. So that's kind of how it all came apart. Now, I am constantly talking to our operations chief and our battalion chiefs. They're in the same house that I am. And I probably go into much greater detail with them on kind of what my expectations are as we kind of fine-tune them. I always use the analogy of an old four-barrel carburetor. My first car was a Chevelle 396 SS with a 396 big block motor. I had a four-barrel carburetor, and I was constantly tinkering with it. It was either too rich or too lean, you know, trying to get the maximum horsepower. So I spend a lot of time with the ops chief and the shift commanders talking about that to do two things. Number one, maintain what we have, because that can all change overnight. And then to identify areas where we can get just a little better at being firefighters, at being paramedics, as being public servants. Does that answer your question?
Yep. And what I wanted to ask you that for to get into is, because the way I saw it, and I've seen you share it before and offer to share it with people, and to me it was a way that as the chief of department, you really made your expectations known is through your training standards of not just
– yes.
It's not the simple, you got to train this many hours a week or this many hours a shift, this many hours a year, or so much on this topic, this, that, the target solutions, all that, but actual having measurable training standards. And then being willing to share them with people. It's not hidden into your department saying, hey, this is what we require of our people. I think that's good that it gets out there. Other people can see it. Not every department does that. But to me, that's what, for me as a company officer, if I'm looking at the chief of department, I'm seeing your expectations to me right there. When you put out not just your training standard of, hey, I want you to train this much, but you actually give me something measurable, a time standard of you need to be able to perform this skill to this proficiency. I think that, to me, that's what stood out to me in seeing things you've done and talking to people and saying that's where I really saw, you know, to me personally, your expectations of your people put out there, because it's not just a, I want you to go this and do what you want as long as you did something. You have a measurable standard that says this is the standard. You are either this good or we're gonna have to fix it. But you're gonna perform to this level of competency.
Well, if you think about it, Anthony, there's only two ways that I know of. I may not know, you know, I may be missing something. But there's only two ways that you can get that uniformity and predictability on the fire ground, and that you can commit to a chosen culture, and that's through standards. There's no other way. I think one of the things that really disappoints me about the fire service, and I'm going to make some people angry by saying this, but I've actually, and very recently, talked to these firefighters, and they actually have it in their union contracts when they can train, restricting training. You know, we're not going to train if it's after this time or this day, or if it's too hot or if it's too cold, and only the training officer. So it's almost like training is a punishment. But my God, if you think about it, your life, your survivability, and the survivability of the people that we serve is dependent on our level of that mental, physical, mechanical, procedural preparedness. That's pretty freaking huge. And I don't know why firefighters view training as meaningless work. Well, I do know, because who's ever in charge of it, that's how they present it. But, you know, I'll quote John Salka, retired from the 18th Battalion. You know, he says training is the only thing. The only way we are successful is through our commitment to preparedness. You can't be a rock star on the fire ground if you're a knucklehead in the firehouse. And so the commitment to that preparedness is the only way that we become a organization where people can depend on us and where people want to come work and stay with us. And so that to me is just huge. And I don't know any other way to get that other than having some established performance standards. And standards can be evaluated in two ways, on time or by finish, right? You know, on search, we're a little bit more concerned about the time element. When we're stretching, we're a little bit more concerned about the finish, you know, how it lays out so that we can advance quickly. And so if you focus on that, it gives you kind of a benchmark to strive for. If I'm a captain and I get somebody new into my firehouse, here's the standard. This is what we're going to work towards. And so it just takes care of a lot of problems. But we got to have a culture that values training and values success and doesn't look at training as just meaningless labor or punishment or something negative. I just don't know how organizations get there.
Yeah, we've actually talked about that before, and that's been an experience my department had years ago that you still see some of the guys that were around for that time frame just have that attitude towards training, because we had a chief that was pretty high up in the department that used it as discipline. So once it became discipline, they've always you got people that they have this bad taste in their mouth for it because it was used to discipline them, not to better them. And now they're hesitant anytime someone calls them for training. Now, if it's company level, they're good. But it's like when they get – if you get called in, it's like, man, what do we do? What's this about? You know, and it left that lasting impression that's now being passed on by some people to another generation of our job because someone used it as discipline, you know.
That's too bad. That's really too bad. And
that was – go ahead. You're good.
No, I was just going to say it was that way when I went into Louisville. There was a group there who did the exact thing. You know, they'd take people down to the training tower for 2 or 3 hours and just wear them flat out. And it was more about breaking them down than building them up. And you know, that's just wrong. And I'll tell you, if somebody's not into training and doing it, not for me, it's not doing it for Scott Thompson, but if they're not coming in to train for the members, the men and women that they're riding the rigs with, that they're serving with, and for our citizens, they're not welcome into our fire department. I have no use for you. I don't care how good you think you are. And you know, I talk about quality training and not quantity training. You know, you can do a lot of great stuff in 45 minutes to an hour if you think it out, if you plan it out, and it's the information is accurate. I just don't understand that. I don't know if I ever will, and I don't want to be a part of any of that. I don't. Those people may be great people, but those aren't the kind of people that I want in my organization.
No, I agree. All right, so we kind of went through my questions, and I want to kind of let you go with whichever angles you want with these two topics. But I want to start with, because we've kind of hit on it more than the other topic, but just firehouse culture, fire department culture. What, you know, you've already talked about some of the things you did to create, and with the help of the people you put in certain positions to create a culture that you have within your department. But I mean, I think it says a lot about the culture you have when you can say you haven't had anyone leave other than through retirement and however many years it is now. I mean, that's pretty incredible. I mean, I know the bigger departments are, the harder that's going to get because people are going to leave when you're dealing with just massive amounts of people. But to be able to say over that many years in a decent-sized fire department, it's not like you only have a couple members. You guys have a good amount of guys that no one's leaving. I mean, that to me, that says a lot. Without talking to anyone there, you can just hear that and say, no one's left. What's going on here? That there's something going on here that everyone's staying, that, you know what I mean? There's always going to be an outlier that no matter what, they're unhappy. So, you know, can you go into some of that firehouse culture, department-wide culture, and how you went about to create all that?
Yes, but let me update my stats, and this has just happened in the last year. We've now had three people leave. We had one person who came here. They had a baby, and their family was back home, and so they went back home. That was number one. We had somebody that we hired just a year ago who came to us from a like-size organization who didn't like it here. They didn't like the standards. You know, they thought we were maybe a little too much over the top, so they went back to their organization. My assumption is that, you know, they came to us for the 4896 work schedule. Their organization afterwards went to it. That's why they went back. And we just recently had a firefighter leave to become an assistant chief in another organization. So we've had three people leave in 14 years for another fire department job. But, so every organization has a culture. If there's a group of people, there's going to be a culture, and you have two choices. You can either accept the culture that's going to develop, and every organization has one, or you can sit down and have conversations and identify the things that you want your culture to value. That's really what culture is when you break it down. It's the things that the organization values. And you can sit down and have that conversation and then pursue a culture of choice and create a culture that values the things that you want it to. For example, our culture values letting firefighters be firefighters. Our culture values training and high performance. And so the culture, to me, and this is going to go against every leadership book you've ever read, but I'm going to qualify it here in a minute. To me, the most important thing in any organization is the culture. That's number one, and the people are number two. Most leadership books are always going to say your people are number one. Now, our people are very important, but this is my thought. If we're going to go out and try to get the best people, we need to put them in a healthy culture. If I have a toxic culture, I can go out and hire all the great firefighters in the world, but then I put them in a toxic culture, pretty soon they're going to be something different than they were when we hired them. So when I say the culture is number one, it's to create a culture that we can bring people into the organization and position them for success and survival instead of putting them in a culture that's going to allow them to drift towards failure. So I spent the first 14 years in the colony really focusing on culture. I've even said in some of my classes that in my top list of top three most important things as the fire chief, one of them is to manage the culture daily. And I take it that seriously. And I believe that my operations chief, my shift commanders, and my company officers kind of do the same thing. So it's just hugely important. Now, every December, and I've got this from Stephen Covey's Seven Habits, it's sharpening your saw. Every December, I kind of reset my priorities. I evaluate how things were the previous year and set my priorities for the next year. So I've just recently made the decision that for the next 4 or 5 years that I'm in the colony, I'm really going to start to focus on people, because I think we got the culture really where it's gotten roots, and it's sustainable. We know it's sustainable. So I'm now really going to focus on developing people. But if you neglect the culture, there's so many influences that pretty soon it gets away from you. And I believe wholeheartedly that the reason that the people come to the colony and stay in the colony, it's certainly not me. It's just because of this culture, and it values the things that they value. And that's really what it's all about, is people are going to go to organizations to where the values are compatible. And so we talk about it a lot. We did something a long time ago. I wrote about it in a book called The Colony Project, where we really broke the organization down. And the reason we did it is because we had this zero turnover at the time, and we wanted to find out why that was. We wanted to identify, the specifics, on why people were coming to the organization, why they were staying. But what was really amazing is why people were taking a cut in pay and a cut in seniority. This last class we just hired, and I won't mention his name because I don't want to embarrass him, but he came from a little bigger organization, fights a little bit more fire. He's involved in their recruit training. I mean, just involved in everything they do. And he was getting ready to be promoted to lieutenant. And he turned down that promotion to come to the colony and start all over as a candidate. And so we wanted to figure out why that was, because we didn't want to make a decision or do something that would ruin that. And that's really where we found out how much people value purpose, commitment to the mission, the things that the organization values, the let firefighters be firefighters. All those things contribute to that, and are all things that our culture values. So it is just so, so important. And there's a lot of chiefs that will disagree with it. There's still a lot of people who don't think culture is a real thing. But I can tell you with 100% certainty, whether it's in the organization as a whole, the organizational culture, or the subcultures, which is a shift or a battalion, or the microcultures, the firehouse or the fire company, that culture matters. And it is, you know, compensation is important. You can't be way off. I mean, everybody wants to have a comfortable lifestyle, and they want to feel valued. And so you got to be in the ballpark with compensation, but it's not the deciding factor. The culture is. And I know that from interviewing close to 500 people. Our organization's right at 100 and hiring 61. And that's what we heard time and time and time again. They like the culture. They like the idea of quality training. They like the idea of letting firefighters be firefighters. All those things are important to the people that we're bringing into the organization. Now, we have an obligation. You know, if I'm all talk and no action, I can sit here all day and tell you a lot of great things. But if we don't live up to them, you know, firefighters are very smart people. That word gets around. So we have a huge obligation to deliver that kind of environment. And that's one of the things that kind of keeps me up at night. Like I said, I just got a firefighter who gave up a lot to come to our organization. Now the burden's on me to make sure that he made the right decision and that we deliver what we said we were going to be.
Yeah, so I want to build off of that and go into when I hear your name at a conference or your class is on the list of the conference I'm going to hear, it's what comes to mind is leadership, but not just overall, just broad leadership, but that small group of being a leader to an individual group of people, and specifically mentoring. I think between your class, your book, that there's not many other resources that compare when it comes to talking about mentoring, and then especially when you stack on your mentoring program. To me, the people you have as your mentors are really going to dictate your career, and they're probably going to dictate some other things about your life that's not just the fire department. They're going to have such an impact. They're going to have a change on your life as a whole. That's been my experience. I was talking about this in Carolina Beach last weekend with Steve. Steve Robertson's a huge mentor of mine, Todd Edwards. But I was talking to Steve, and we talk about mentorship a lot. And I think one of the biggest things with mentoring is when you're looking at who's going to be your mentors and who you're going to try to learn from and follow and all this, you can't just have the guy that's going to tell you what you want to hear either. He can't just be the guy that's going to put the time into you and teach you and just give you the good. I mean, that's one of the – Steve's one of my biggest mentors, and I love him to death, and one of the reasons why is he tells me what I need to hear. He'll give me the good stuff. Hey, you're doing good at this. He'll tell me what I don't want to hear too, but that I need to hear, because that's how I'm going to improve. If you could just tell me the what I want to hear all the time, I'm going to be very limited in how far I can grow. But if you're willing to have, you know, a tough conversation with me and say, hey, man, you're messing up right here, or, hey, man, you suck at this. You should get better, you know, maybe in different words. But you know what I mean? Like, you've got to be willing to have those conversations with somebody and say, hey, I know you don't want to hear this. I'm not being mean. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings. But this is what you got to hear if you want to get better, if you want to grow. And I don't think you can truly grow or get better if you don't hear that. So I've tried to pick mentors personally like Steve that will have a conversation with me and say, hey, man, you're doing really good at this. What about this? One of the biggest things, Steve, Ray, Todd, they're all telling me all the time, man, don't let the fire department come in place of your family. You got kids. Don't ever lose time with your kids, to go to class. They keep that in my mind nonstop. You get to a conference, you get all into it. It's not that you forget, but you're into this class. They're constantly letting you know the fire department's still going to be here. You know, this is what's important. Learn from us. We've been there before. And I think that's very important. And I look at that on mentorship, that they will have that conversation with you on no matter what it is, a skill you're lacking at. They see something going on and willing to sit down and talk to you. Hey, man, you got something going on in your personal life you need to talk about. You're kind of off, you know, and maybe catch something there. But they got to be willing to have those conversations with you that are uncomfortable. And that's what I've found with the mentors I have and I've been around. But I'd really like you to go into detail as much as you want on your thoughts on mentorship and then about your mentoring program. And I think Todd said it earlier, but the fact that you offer to give people your stuff for free, I mean, I think that's amazing. Most people won't do that today. You know what I mean? If they develop something, they don't want to give it to somebody. And I hear you, like, every time you do a class, say, here, I'll give you a copy of my mentoring program. Just email me. Just don't try to sell it to somebody. I'm giving it to you so you can help somebody else. And I don't think there's a lot of that, you know, in today's world. So I think that stands out and also goes to your thoughts on leadership and mentoring.
Well, and you did a great job of describing what mentoring is. And you know, you and I are very fortunate because we get to hang around great people like the ones you mentioned, Todd and Steve. I got to hear Bobby Hoff this past week and Larry McCormick. I was with my best buddy, Mike Arrico, who's retired from Oaklawn, who's a huge mentor of mine. And so we're very blessed, right? And mentoring – I am all for traditional mentoring, and that's a lot what you described. Either we seek out somebody or somebody sees potential in us and seeks us out, and that's great. If we could have that across the board, then there would be no need for the document that I put out. But what got my attention is those men and women that maybe are not as outgoing or they're not in an organization that values training or whatever, that they don't get the benefits that you and I have gotten from having great mentors in our life. And so the best way that I could approach that was to create a formal mentoring process which organizations could adopt to assure that everybody in the organization, from the quietest, least popular, to the most outgoing, most popular, could experience from exactly what you described. You did a great job. So I was very passionate about that. You know, I always cringe. I walk away from a conversation where guys start dogging on the young kids, the new generation in the fire service, right? Stop whining about it and do something about it. This is one of my action steps to address that. If you've read the packet, I talk about mentoring entitlement. I talk about mentoring maturity. I got two sons that are in the fire department. One's in Dallas and one's in Arlington. They know so much more than I did as a firefighter. The only advantage that they had when they walked into the firehouse is they had a father who mentored them and said, these are the things that you need to look for. These are the things that you need to do. This is the commitment that you have to make. And you need to start forming the type of person that you want people to think of you as. So that's about it. They went in, they did the rest. But if I don't have a dad or a brother or somebody to give me that insight, and I walk into a firehouse and I've never been in one, it's one of the most intimidating environments on the planet. And so it's very, very unfair to write off this generation. So all as I wanted to do is to create something that gave everybody a shot to benefit from that mentoring relationship. And I believe in it because, you know, I say it that I believe the future of fire service learning and leadership is mentoring because we're in a society now where we want that one-on-one relationship. We want to understand the why, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's another pet peeve of mine. These salty old guys, well, the kids are always asking why, and, you know, you should thank them for wanting to know the why because they want a deeper level of understanding. But because of our nature, all type A personalities, we look at that as a threat. Well, how dare you ask me why? You know, we almost take it as they're questioning us when in reality, it's a compliment. They want to learn from us. They want to know more from us. So we, every kid that comes up and asks why, we should shake their hand and say, thank you for asking why. Thank you for having enough interest to understand, to have a little more insight, to understand the job a little better. So I'm going to give full credit to Rick Lasky. You know, I've been on the receiving end of a lot of great mentoring relationships, starting back from my first captain, Ernie Roys, my senior firefighter, Randy Stone, Kevin Wilkerson, had a huge influence. And so when I went to Louisville, Rick had just kind of started a project called the Mentoring Book, and that's kind of where I started focusing on something more than just traditional mentoring. And I just became fascinated by it. And we had such great results from our mentoring program in Louisville that I was excited to come to the colony and try to take it to the next level. And so that's all that the thing that I put out, and that's why I don't want to charge for it, is because it has the soul of so many other people in there. I couldn't sleep at night if I took a penny for it. And my wife helped me with it. And, you know, we didn't make it real, real fancy so that there's not a lot of cost to it. But I just wanted to do something for the fire service. So I saw an opportunity through mentoring to put a document in leaders' hands or senior men or women or formal, informal leaders, whatever you want to call it, to help them. Number one, understand kind of what mentoring is. There's coaching. We all do a great job at coaching. You know, during hands-on training, that's what we do. We coach, right? We show them, we demonstrate, and then we allow them to do it. We give them some feedback, and we allow them to do it again. We do a great job of that. Mentoring is positioning people for long-term success. We help them understand the job. We help them become problem solvers. We help them understand themselves. And like you said, you want mentors that are going to that they're going to tell you what you need to know, not what you want to hear. And so, you know, I'm getting way too much credit for it. It's you know, It's just something that I felt obligated to do, and the best way that I felt to do it was just to put together a packet, put it out there, and hope people like you and Todd and those people maybe during a class would mention it, and just help people understand that mentoring is really important, and this is how you get there. The other part of mentoring is we're all in phases of our career in learning and passing on. And so I identified five developmental phases, if you will. And this can really help an organization as they bring people in and help them to advance through the organization. So like the first phase of mentoring is to orient, right, to bring somebody in, and whether it's a new hire or newly promoted, you want to orient them to the position. And that's a pretty formal phase. We spend a lot of time with task books and checkoffs and all those others. And we want to make sure that they're getting good information. The information is accurate, that it's been vetted, that it meets our standards, and that we're putting out the message that we want the men and women in our organization to hear. The next is to develop them in that position, to help them gain confidence, skill, knowledge, and experience. And by experience, I mean turn events into experience. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of fire companies that are going to fires as we speak, and they're getting back in the house, and they hadn't learned a damn thing. And they're going to get off tomorrow, and they said they went to a fire, but they didn't learn anything from that fire. So mentoring helps turn those events into actual experiences. The next is to prepare people to step up at the next level of the organization so that they understand the jobs above them, so that they can function in that capacity. The next is to master something. You know, I was just down in South Bend, and I'm just going to use Sam Hiddle as an example. You know, there's somebody who has mastered forcible entry. I don't know if Sam is a master in everything that he does, but when you think of Sam Hiddle, you think of forcible entry, right? You think of Steve Robertson. Oh, yeah. You think of estimating the stretch. All of us have that thing that we're passionate about, where we're going to take it to the next level, where we're going to do the work, the research, all the things, and put that out there to help people get the next level of understanding. And then the final phase is passing on. And every one of us has an obligation to pass on what has been given to us. Experience that is not shared is wasted. And so that's really, really what it is. It comes from my strong belief of the impact that mentoring can have on an organization, and then just helping people feel comfortable. Now the two downsides that I've heard about mentoring is one that we force it on organizations, and it's a fair statement. There's people out there who believe mentoring should occur very organically, and by creating a formal process, you're forcing the mentoring relationship, and as they see it, somehow that does harm or that's not as effective. The other is some people fear it's somehow going to result in disciplinary action. I mean, I've heard that. I don't know where that comes from. That tells me they have a toxic culture. You got to have a fairly healthy culture, and they got to believe in learning and wanting to get better. Mentoring is never going to work. So, you know, my goal is I'd love to see that mentoring document get in the hands of every person in the fire service, and not my name, it doesn't have to be associated with it or on it. I just want that in anybody's hands, we can get it in. And then, like I say, the only thing I ask is that somebody doesn't turn a few things and go out and start charging $2,000 a day, because then it becomes, you know, then it's not obtainable by everybody. When we start putting dollars to it, there's some people that can't afford it, and then we start to leave those people out. And mentoring is all about including people and helping people reach their full potential if they're willing to put in the work. It's a two-way street. Mentors are there to help guide the energy and the passion and so many things. So that's kind of the backstory on mentoring. I'm just glad that it's been received at the way that it has. And I love to hear stories when somebody comes up to me and they've benefited from a mentoring relationship. That's all the payment I need.
Yeah, so I mean, we've talked about a lot tonight. before we close it out, with my final thoughts are that I hope everyone really listened and didn't just hear what was said, but really listen to it, especially at the end on the mentoring stuff and the impact you can have on people and how much you can help people grow because you're in that role. And sometimes it is formal and it's part of just your duties and the position you're in that job is you get someone new and you're going to be a mentor for them. And other times, like you said, it's more organic and, you know, and maybe it flows better. And either way, it still needs to happen and we have to help people coming on grow. You hit on something, Chief Thompson, that me and Todd have talked about a few times on the show is people that ask the question, why? I'm that generation. It's how I learn. I want to have a full understanding of something. But what we always also say with it when me and Todd have talked about it is it's also important for you to understand when it's okay to ask why. You know, when you tell me to do something on the fire ground, that's probably not the time for me to ask why.
Oh,
if you 100%. React poorly to me, if you react poorly to me saying that, to saying why then, I deserve whatever I get in response to that.
I agree totally.
Where my mentor on the fire department was great in that he was the old salty generation, and, you know, it was he built machines. You went down there, you were known he was going to train more than anybody else. And that's why you went there. I came on the fire department. I was 19 years old. I wanted to go to one of the busiest companies in the city that runs the high rises and the housing projects and all this, but also specifically to work for Ray Hildreth because I knew I would learn the job. A lot of people didn't want to work there because you knew you were going to train every single day. Hose was going on the ground every day. At 19, 20 years old, that's what I wanted. So I put in a transfer. I didn't get the spot at the training center. He asked me to come down there a year later. I was in a neighboring company and got the spot there. But he was always willing to take the time, even though his generation was he created machines. Like I said, if you worked for him, when he said do this, you knew how to do it. Those guys could work and they could get it done. He wasn't from the generation where it was okay to ask why. But when we'd go do a drill or we'd make a fire and we came back, if I had a question, I could say, hey, Captain Ray, I got a question. What did you see that made you make that decision? And he would always take, no matter how much time it took, he would sit on the back tailboard and explain everything to you. So that's exactly what you were doing.
You were asking the why.
Yep. Yep. So, and I think that's where it comes in. You got to know when to ask why. And I think sometimes that's part of the problem is just the why right out the gate. And that's not when it should be said. It's at the right time. But there are those guys that will still do that. Like Todd says, I want people to ask me why. I want them, you said, to have that they want, they're seeking further information so they can understand it further. Hey, if you're willing to ask why, that just tells me you're dialed in. You want to be a good firefighter. You want to know more.
And part of our mentoring is to teach them when to ask why. Hey, don't ask it on the fire ground. When I tell you to pull a 2.5, you do it. You trust me. I'm your boss. We teach them that. But when we get back to the firehouse, ask me why all you want.
Yep, so that's my final thoughts. I'm really hoping everyone listened and really absorbed what was said. Chief.
Anthony, before we check off, I want to offer one more thing.
Okay,
one more thing to people listening, and this applies to everybody. Every one of us listening who does this job, the minute we walk in a firehouse, we're doing one of two things. We're either helping position people for success or survival, or we're allowing them to drift towards failure. What's your influence each day? And I think that's a big-time personal accountability is, do you set people up for success and survival, or do you allow them to drift towards failure? And they're easily correctable, but there has to be an awareness. That's all I wanted to add. And thank you for having me on.
No, I think that's a great way to put it too. That to really understand, you know, where you stand. But I know Todd's already checked off. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to come on the show, share, you know, your experiences and your different positions and how you got to where you are and found that success with people. If anyone needs to reach out to me, has questions, like we always say. You can email me, portcityfiretraining@gmail.com. You can email Todd Edwards6@yahoo.com. Chief, thanks again. And if you would let everyone know how they can reach out to you, get in touch with you if they want to hear your class, where you're going to be teaching, where they can catch your class. And the only other thing we didn't talk about, you can go as much detail as you want, but I highly recommend your class to everybody and your book to everybody. We didn't really talk about the book. To everyone listening, definitely recommend the book if you haven't read it, if you let them know where they can come across it, where they can get it. But thank you again for your time.
No, thank you for having me on, and it was an honor to be with you guys. You can reach me at Scott with two T's at fireserviceleadership.com. If you want to ask me something, I'm on Facebook. I do a lot of stuff on Facebook. That's kind of my means of getting the word out there, since my city doesn't allow me to have a fire department Facebook page. I'm going to be in Little Rock the week after next, the 3rd or 4th, First on, I'm going to be with the Frontier Fools the weekend after that. I'm at A&M in July 23rd and 24th. I'm in Northern California August 18th through 20th. I'm in Alaska September 21st through the 1st, right on down the line. But if anybody's got any questions, please feel free to reach out. I'm a little bit of a procrastinator, so nag me. You can go to Fire Engineering, books and videos to get the book. And anything that I can do, if you want to download the mentoring, if you haven't heard it yet, you can go to fireserviceleadership.com and go to my products. You have to put in a little bit of information, but I got two documents up there currently. I have the formal mentoring process for the fire service, and I also have a document which is also free, which is for company-level training, the basics. Feel free to download both of those and use them any way that you wish. I just ask that you don't turn a profit on them.
All right. Well, thanks again, Chief. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to come on the show and share your thoughts with everyone that does listen in.
You bet, buddy. I look forward to seeing you on the road soon again. You take care, and God bless you and your family. And thank you, Todd, for having me on, and I look forward to seeing you guys soon.
All right. Have a good night, Chief.